Ethnically Ambiguous is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. Hi, Shireen.
Hi, Anna. Wow, what an episode we have for y'all today. An amazing conversation.
Yes, we are joined by award-winning author of multiple books and a new book coming out, which we'll tell you about soon. But we are joined by Azarine van der Vliet Ulumi.
And we talk all about her upbringing, the importance of writing, talking about things that need to be talked about, and her upcoming book, Savage Tongues, on sale August 3rd and available for pre-order right now. It's an amazing conversation. Can't wait for y'all to get to know her. Stay tuned.
Who are we? Where do we come from? Who do we become? What is it to be? What to be is it? Where are we? Who are my parents? Where are my pants? Why were we born? We are Ethnically Ambiguous.
Hi, Shireen.
Hello, Anna. Wow, what a lovely day to see you. We both said this before we started the meeting, but both of us just haven't had a lot of conversation today, so it's kind of nice to start now.
I realized I was like looking at emails and just like grumbling to myself all morning because I'm dealing with email gate right now.
Email gate?
No, I don't know. I just have a lot of emails I had to go through this morning.
Okay, I thought there was some drama in the emails.
Well, there is. Like, we're getting some weird ad stuff. Sorry, guys, if you hear some problematic ads on these episodes. We're just, like, going through and trying to get rid of all the bad ads that are for, like, taxing the poor. Or, like, there's one that's, like, I believe for not taxing the rich. It's like a really weird ad where they're like, come on, guys, give these rich people a break. And we're all what is, who put this out? And why is it on our shows?
So I do appreciate when the listeners are like, hey, we heard this on your show. Don't think it aligns. It's happened a couple times. So I do appreciate the listeners that like understand we don't have a lot of control and they let us know and then we can fix it.
There's also apparently a very aggressive weight loss ad, so I apologize about that. That's going around. There's one called Patriot Supply, which is all about, it's all about like buying like, you know, apocalypse style gear.
Oh God.
For the end of the world, which I guess is when people of color like realize that they like deserve more, then all of a sudden you have to be like, we got to get prepared to fight these.
Yeah.
I don't even know, but so yeah, there's a lot of weird ads going around on our shows right now, and we are working on removing them all. So this has been your PSA.
So sit tight, and we're sorry if any of them, before we remove them, trigger you or make you mad. That's not our intention. These weird companies out there happen to have money to get ads, which blows my mind. But anyway,
we have a great guest today.
nice guest after she heard us talk about all of that stuff. We're really excited to talk to her. She's an award-winning author, multiple award winnings. It's very impressive when I was reading her bio. She's also Persian, and I want Anna to introduce her with the Farsi twang to her name. So go ahead.
Yes, we are joined by Azarine van der Vliet Ulumi.
Yeah, that's what I wanted. The last
welcome.
Little guy.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I also want to point out my cat is trying to get into the closet, so he will be making noise. It's morning, so my cat is really on one. This is around the time where he starts destroying things in my home, so I will be snapping at him occasionally through the recording. As you can see, he's right there.
Yeah. And if you guys hear dogs in the background, again, that's, well, Anna said it before, it's texture, you know? We're inviting you into our homes. I want to also I've been meaning to stop saying you guys basically for years, but I need to figure out a different gender neutral term. I usually say y'all, but like it slips out sometimes. Anyways, Azarine, thank you so much for joining us. You've accomplished so much in a relatively short time, in my opinion, and your third novel, Savage Tongues, comes out on August 3rd, I believe. And we'd love to talk to you about your books in general and that one in particular. But first, I would love to go backwards a bit. And I want to talk to you about your early life and how you found writing, what your upbringing was like.
Wow. Yeah, my early life involved moving and migrating a lot. I think the important pieces is that I was born in the United States but didn't grow up here. We left quite quickly and went to Spain. I briefly lived in the Emirates, and then we came back to the United States, to Los Angeles, and left again, and went to Iran. And I spent my very formative years in Tehran and in Mazandaran from when I was 7 to about 13. Mm. And I think that was one of the most activating experiences that I had, you know, that later informed my writing. Just seeing all of the Farsi language or beautiful calligraphy, you know, on the giant billboards across the autobahns, and, you know, just having a completely different experience of gender and gender boundaries, and growing up in a very matriarchal structure in a mm-hmm. patriarchal country. It was really fascinating. I can trace back a lot of my political consciousness to those years. I also love Iran deeply and appreciate our culture very much. So it's, you know, I think, yeah, those were important years. And after that, we did go back to Spain again, and eventually settled in the United States when I was about halfway through high school. I've stayed since, although I've also taken a few leaves. I'm always in search of home, always feeling like an outsider.
Yeah. Yeah, me and Anna both feel that, but I can't imagine, like, you moved a lot, so there wasn't ever an established, like, home base. Where were you right before 7, or, like, what country were you in right before you were 7 and living in Iran?
You know, my memory isn't actually all that linear, because of how often we moved. Right. I'm pretty sure we were living in the Emirates, came to the United States briefly. I think I did maybe half of second grade here. Wow. And then we left. So a lot of the timeline is scrambled because of the frequency. Mm-hmm. I mean, at some point we lived in Scotland.
Oh, wow. Why did your family move around so much?
It's a convergence of reasons. My father, he's British. He went to sea when he was 14. He grew up in a working class family in the, in East London, and then went, you know, on his father's side, everybody lived at sea most of their lives, or were sea captains or mariners. And so he went off to sea and did nautical school, and he lived at sea most of his life and intended to do so for the rest of his life. But he got tuberculosis when he was, I think he was like in his very early 30s and wasn't allowed to be on the ships. He survived it, but couldn't live on ships anymore. And then he ended up in Iran a year before the revolution happened in 79, and was going to work, you know, offshore with oil companies because his knowledge of ships is pretty profound. And then the revolution happened. Him and my mom met and they escaped. Mm-hmm. He was under house arrest and often interrogated, but they did get out. And I think that the revolution on my mom's side and my dad's background as a sailor who lives adrift, the convergence of those two things and the political trauma and their own eccentric personalities all led to us moving a lot. So there's no clear answer, to be honest.
I like that answer more than anything else I've heard, like work or something, you know, like that's your dad sounds fascinating, first of all. I can't even imagine his family, his father's before him living at sea. Even that phrase is like, what?
Feels like it's something from a different era. I mean, he's 80. He turns 80 this year. And, you know, I'm 38. He was born during the war, or right the year the war ended, or World War II. So it's a completely different world that he comes from. And sometimes it feels really inaccessible and remote. I'm always joking with him that he still doesn't know how to live on dry land.
Is that kind of also why you guys went to Spain? Because there's, actually, I've never been to Spain, but I'm curious if there's like living on the boat lifestyle sort of, I don't know what I'm even saying, but like, is that kind of what goes on? And is that why you went to Spain is also what I'm asking. Are there boats
Spain
there?
Spain is really different. It's more like people sipping their drink.
Oh yeah, like super yachts?
Well, no, they went to Spain because after the really intense harrowing, I mean, he was interrogated in Avin day in, day out, wow, and under house arrest. And I think any assets they would have had were frozen. You know, people from Iran, as you know, were dispersed all over. People yeah. went to Germany. Very few people went to Spain, but people went to Germany. They went to Sweden, to Switzerland, yeah. to the United States. And they just happened to go there because I think Franco had died recently and Spain was opening up, but it was still very mm-hmm. affordable to live there. Mm-hmm. And like I said, to be honest, they are both pretty difficult characters to keep up with, you know, they make interesting choices, which don't always yeah. have rational explanations. But yeah, that's how we ended up there. That's where they went right after they got out.
That's interesting. I had some of my dad's family went to Spain from Syria. So as far as the Arab community goes, it seemed like it was really, because I was there when I was younger and there's a thriving Arabic community.
It's deeply Islamic. And, mm-hmm. you know, there's still so much of the food and the architecture and the music is influenced by Arab and North African yeah. culture. Yeah.
That's interesting. I mean, I can't imagine, like, living in Iran. I mean, something you said that stuck out to me is just, like, living under this kind of matriarchal family situation in a world or in, like, a country that's so, you know, men positive, if you will. Because I do actually find that to be the case. Like when I go and see my family in Iran, like I do feel like my aunts, you know, like my khales, my ammes are like more in charge in a way. Like they are actually like the backbone of the structure of our family. 4 or 5 years ago, my uncle passed and he was like the, in quotes, patriarch of the family. Like he was just the oldest who like was the guy everyone looked up to and respected and just like everyone listened to him. But when he died, I kind of started to see truly actually like my aunt was the one who was keeping everything together. Because I thought when he died, it was like everything was gonna, you know, collapse. Mm-hmm. But like then when I was there in Iran for his funeral, I was like, no, like she's truly like the stone. Like I'm watching her like be so strong for her entire family and take this role on as the person who's now officially like the one everyone looks up to was very eye-opening to me. Like they are living in this country that, you know, truly prioritizes men over anything. But like the underlying issue is that like the women are actually the people who keep everything together. And I feel like within like I kind of see my mom like that too. Like my mom is very quiet and she's not like very in your face. And my dad's just like a loud, you know, Persian man. But like, it's truly like a lot of what happens is like my mom is the one who gets the final say. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I'm really just kind of processing this now as I'm speaking, as like things have come up in the past. But I think that's just a very interesting concept of like how we see it and how it's portrayed by, you know, media and the government and all that. But then like who's truly yeah. like the person who keeps it all, literally holds it down for the family. It is the woman.
Mm-hmm. I think that might be across, because I can relate to that too as an Arab. Like, I think maybe it's like a Middle Eastern, obviously every family is different, but I do think that the woman has so much responsibility. And I think at a certain point, the men become codependent and when it comes to heterosexual relationships anyway, because that's what I see with my family. It's like, at a certain point, they just rely so much on the female presence, like in everything she does, even if it's like a stereotypical. The work that she does is very like, what's the word? Like patriarchal, very just like, I don't know, cook, clean, whatever. But yeah, I think you're right. I think at the end of the day, the women have more power than the men want to admit, kind of thing.
Yeah, I think there's also, I mean, I don't want to say there's always female solidarity because that's just not true in, yeah. you know, as a blanket statement. But I think when women spend, at least in my upbringing, you know, I was with my mom, my grandmother, my aunt, and they were all either divorced or widowed. And they didn't necessarily have solidarity, but at the same time, they had each other's backs and they understood their social capital as in very gendered ways, right? They were not encouraged to work outside of the home. And that was something that was passed down for a couple of generations. And of course, you know, when people got, when they had to go into exile and leave the country, and those infrastructures that were patriarchal, that were, you know, legible to them as women, that they could navigate, disappeared. They don't transplant. Those structures can't be transplanted onto the American landscape. And I think that they struggled and suffered a lot, especially being widowed or divorced with children or alone. So, you know, I think it's, there's something really interesting that happens in these domestic spaces that are heavily female. I think they're so queer in some ways too. There's a lot of fluidity and kinds of different expressions of desire and love that emerge in those spaces, and a kind of collective sense of humor about men, like the ways in which they would poke fun at the patriarchy when they were together, was really fascinating to me. So, you know, I think there's, yeah, they have a lot of hidden power for sure.
Yeah. I love that you said that you brought up the queerness, because I've always felt that in my family too. Like, not necessarily that like everyone is queer, but like as a queer person myself, I couldn't ignore that there was just like this other kind of love that I don't think that maybe they didn't even realize. I also saw it with men, honestly, when they were all together. Like, I see photos of my dad and his friend when he was younger, and like they're like close, you know? Like, it's just like, because maybe because it's so segregated in like traditional Muslim communities, I think the closeness becomes different and very, and there's a different kind of love that's like beautiful, to be honest. But obviously I don't think they should be segregated, but at the same time, when there's a different kind of love that emerges from that and like unity sometimes, I think it's kind of beautiful.
Yeah, for sure. And there is a lot of love that we don't have language for in English. It's a different quality. I mean, yeah, queer is the only way I can describe it, because I feel like I transitioned, you know, into finding my queer friends in America. And we all define queerness differently. You know, I'm married to a cisgendered man. And so, you know, I still identify as queer because of the way that I am and my fluidity. But when I found my queer friends, who are now my kind of queer family in the United States, there was an energy there that felt very familiar to the matriarchal energy I grew up with.
Yes.
Even though some of my friends are trans and have transitioned in, you know, every direction, but I don't know what it is. I don't know if maybe it's something that is hard to articulate, but there is an energy.
I don't think there's language for it. I think you're right. I think there's a lot of things that there's not a concise word or language for. So
yeah, and it's true. It happens between the men as well. There's a kind of eros or like a affection there that's very embodied. Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah.
So you came back, you said, around like mid-high school-ish?
I came back actually in eighth grade. And then the next time I came back, I did ninth grade in three different places. And then after 10th grade, we stayed.
Okay.
Those are like such formative years. That's so, yeah. I don't know. It must have been so jarring to like experience puberty and like all these things, just like one place to another. I don't know.
Very jarring. It becomes difficult to keep up, and you have to become extremely self-reliant. I think I also was very, home was always a very kind of precarious thing. So I did learn to be really self-sufficient. Self-sufficiency can be so good and useful, and also later also be harmful, right? So I had to learn, you know, when it was time to relax and build community, I had to learn how to do that. And that was an interesting journey.
Yeah. I have 100 questions, but we got to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with Azarine. All right, we are back. Okay, so back. 1 of 100 questions. Are you an only child?
No.
Oh, okay. So you have siblings. What was that experience? Like, did it help having siblings around you when you were traveling or, you know, moving around?
Not necessarily. I mean, I have a brother, and so we were pretty segregated from each other at school in Iran. I mean, obviously it was nice to have a brother at home, but I think that he learned some of the worst parts of being an Iranian man and was encouraged to monitor me growing up. So for example, I couldn't go to a birthday party without him. So I was under constant surveillance. And I think that that was also, I don't feel any resentment towards that. I think it was really a formative experience. And I think it was important to see the ways in which these structures then play themselves out in intimate families. And that's a lot of what I'm working through in Savage Tongues. But later when we came back to the United States, he left and went to go live with my father. So it was just my mother and I. So I didn't have a sibling really intimately at that point. And I did miss him. You know, he was, you know, even though the relationship was set up in these ways that were problematic, his absence wasn't that easy to take when I was in high school, for sure.
Yeah. And where did you guys land when you came to America?
We actually lived in Reno, Nevada, very briefly.
And so you come back, you're in 10th grade. Now, how is that readjusting to this new place? And like, actually, I'm curious, did you think you were going to move again? Or did you actually think like, oh, we'll be here for a while?
Oh, I had no idea.
Okay.
I didn't even ask that question. I was pretty adaptable. I do remember being really quiet in 10th grade and just kind of retreating. I think just puberty, like you said, puberty plus moving. But then I found my tribe, you know, that's been one thing that's always been great. I found these amazing friends who are also living in these kinds of precarity situations or liminal situations. You know, first gen children of immigrants. Most of my friends were from Honduras and Egypt, and we just formed a group and pulled each other up. And that was great. You know, we all had jobs. Two of them worked at, God, that pretzel company.
Wetzel's Pretzels. Annie's?
Yes. And I worked at Ruby's Diner in California. And so we would always hang out after our shifts, you know, and feed each other and then sleep at each other's homes and then carpool back to high school the next morning. And it was weird because, you know, we were surrounded by all these kids who are quite financially privileged. And so we really stuck together and we had a blast. We would drive on the freeway in our rickety cars. And
yeah, that's such a big difference between life in Iran, probably when you were like kind of your brother was more encouraged to monitor you or it was just very segregated. I'm curious when you found writing as your catharsis or like the way you expressed yourself throughout all this. Was it always something that you did by yourself or how did you come to realize that you loved to write?
I think I realized it before I started writing. So I realized how powerful language is when I was in middle school in Iran. And I've shared this story before in other forms, I think, but basically when in school, when we were in our sort of language class, Farsi language class, they had us, one of my teachers who was quite religious, you know, my family is split. There, some people are very religious, others are quite secular, but they had us copy the story of Khomeini's rise to power 5 times in our notebooks.
Oh, wow.
And I don't know if I was just a sensitive kid or what, but I just said, I'm not going to do that. And I didn't necessarily have an issue with the story itself. I had an issue with the idea that I had to copy something 5 times and that being the only thing that I'd been asked to do that with. I remember having a visceral reaction that I was being programmed or that this was a kind of history turned propaganda. And I was suspended for not wanting to do it. I really kind of stuck to my guns and I was like, I'm not, you know, you can suspend me. This is fine. And in fact, I felt even more stubborn after they suspended me, you know? So I realized, you know, language must be really powerful. If certain things get repeated, other things get erased. It's like a form of mind control or, you know, whatever. And then, you know, I didn't write per se, but I kept a notebook, apparently, when I was going back and forth in eighth and ninth grade from the United States and back. And my best friend, sophomore year, who was Egyptian, you know, we were always up in each other's business. And somehow she discovered the notebook and read it all without telling me. And then she came up to me and she was like, "You need to be a writer."
Wow.
And that was, I think, the first moment I felt incredibly invaded and confused because I remember writing these things, but and then it just kind of happened from there. I started writing and never stopped.
Wow. That's a good friend. I mean, like, also violating, but like at the same time, I like that she saw something that was like, you should nurture this.
Yeah. I mean, talk about those matriarchal relationships, right? Those spaces are just so intimate, to the point of being boundaryless, right? And I think there's something, when we talk about queerness, that might be one way of articulating it, right? It's like,
yeah,
they're so transformative.
I agree. I can see why so much of your writing focuses on several things at the same time. Like, you write about exile and how it, the impact it can have on the human psyche and like the emotional landscape of those individuals. And I can see why you would be interested in that just based off of like everything you've been through. And I was reading that your second book, Call Me Zebra, it took you like years to conceive and to write. What was the experience like? And also I wrote down this quote that really stuck out to me because it's something that I also am fascinated by. But you were saying that this book deals with the question of, can we really retrace our footsteps as migrants and access a space and a time and a self that existed in a previous iteration and a different cultural and linguistic landscape? Like, that is, you wrote out what I think so many children and young adults feel when it comes to, can I actually have a space here? Is, what if I, what, in a different iteration of my life, like what would I have been like? And like all this stuff. I just love that quote. I just love it.
Thanks. I mean, I think that's it, right? Like the spaces we live in put pressure on our identities, right? Good and bad. And yeah. I don't think we can really tell like what we want in any given moment in life, what we desire or despise is so deeply informed by this, the kind of social pressures of each geographic space.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not like you're one static human, right? That when we move from space to space, like there's a core part of us that remains the same, but we're so, our personalities are so plastic, you know? And so mm-hmm. is the mind when it's developing in those young ages. So I'm always curious, like ships in the night, what would I have been like if I hadn't left Iran? Sometimes it it sometimes really frightens me because given that I was that way when I was 7 and I got, or 10 and I got suspended, I can imagine what I would be behaving like, right? Pretty unruly. And on the other hand, maybe I would be so much less melancholic or nostalgic for Iran. I don't know. It's, it's always a process of like trying to reverse engineer your identity to figure out what happened.
I think about that a lot.
Yeah,
like, same. What if I had been raised in Iran with like my cousins? When I'm there, there's some cousins on my dad's side who are like, you would have been married off already. Like, I literally had a cousin who said that and I was like, oh, what the hell? You know, like, okay. And it's like, that's disturbing in a way where I'm like, okay, you know, no, okay, I can't even wrap my mind around that. But then sometimes I like think about it, like, what if I was just like in Iran, a young
married
wife,
children,
like, I don't even know. Well, I guess now I wouldn't be a young wife. But when I was told that I was younger, the age of 31, just so young. But it's surreal to think about. And then a part of me is like maybe I shouldn't be so like judgmental of such a concept in my own mind, because it's like, I have a lot of like issues when it comes to just like my existence now of like how deep into social media I am and like just like how, like I have issues with the fact that I even like do a podcast because I hate the idea of like my voice being out there. Like I have so all these anxieties and stressors and like just things that like make me feel, you know, like the world's closing in on me. Just, you know, I'm a natural adult in this country. But I think like, well, what if I just had a simple life? Like, I just wasn't so obsessed with these things of like existing in like the public sphere with a podcast or on Twitter or whatever, social media. What if I was just a person who was married and had kids and just existed in this country, and like, it wasn't about all these like materialistic things that I've grown to love because I was raised in this country. Like, and I'm not saying like women in Iran are simple. I'm just saying like the existence I've seen, like my cousins live, where they're not so obsessed with these sorts of things. It's like, what if I just had that sort? Like, would I actually be at more peace in that situation?
Yeah. I think about that a lot. For me, it's like nature nurture. Like I have a lot of like mental struggles and stuff. Like, would I have still the same amount of like problems if I wasn't so like, I don't know, at odds with my identity here, you know, if I just had the one identity, like I am Syrian, you know, or like they don't really take mental health seriously there. So maybe I wouldn't even have known I was depressed, or like maybe I wasn't even depressed. I don't know. Like, how much is nature versus nurture? Like, how much, it really trips me out thinking of how would my personality and identity change?
Yeah.
Depending on where I was. I think about that constantly. But okay, yeah. Back to you, Azarine.
I was just laughing because of the kind of discourse around mental health in the Swana.
Oh, I've been through it. I have two sisters.
It's like mental health it's not a thing.
It doesn't exist.
Yeah, there's no discourse.
No, I was,
they're just like,
I have
no,
two sisters.
Get over it.
And I was like the trouble child. I was the first time my parents had even had to like think critically, like, why is this child so fucked up and sad? And it was just I went through it for real with like so many different things, but I'm glad that at least it's getting a little better, like very minuscule steps, to be honest, as far as like my extended family goes. But I hope at one point we can just talk openly about it, because I see my family now on like my extended family, and I can just tell like, you would have benefited so much from therapy. Like, I think you're depressed. I think you have anxiety. You know what I mean? Like, it's just, and they don't recognize that as like something that can be addressed. And I think that kind of, I don't know, it saddens me, but one day, hopefully.
Yeah, no, I mean, I understand it entirely. And I think that the mental health gets also not confused with, but it is mixed up with political trauma and historical trauma and like geopolitical conflict. And it's really hard to tear the two apart. And I wonder sometimes if the fact that like our parents and our parents' parents, they've been in struggle for so long. And now we have this massive refugee crisis, this ongoing 20-year belligerent war, right? That the United States just launched illegally. And I mean, all of those things, I can't imagine being in a situation of daily survival and being able to recognize or identify or name or address mental health. Like, there is a way in which when we come out of those situations and into life in a different way where we have the space to consider those things. I just don't know. For my family, I don't think they had the space.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think now that you say it that way, it's definitely a privilege to have the space to think about your mind, because, I mean, my parents didn't have easy lives. My mom had a difficult upbringing, to say the least, and she never really talked about it or complained about it or even recognized it as something that fucked her up at all. She's a very strong, normal person, and they never had to really question. They just had to keep going, you know? And I think that's why I kind of believe in the idea of generational trauma. It doesn't even if it's addressed, I think there's something there that like our body holds onto and passes from one generation to the next.
Yeah, I agree. I think all the things that they haven't addressed like exist in our bodies, right? It like just got deposited, and
100%.
And plus we have these ambiguous identities, you know, where you're not fully Syrian, I'm not fully Iranian, you know, we're not neither here nor there, you know, we're not white, but we're white passing, and not all of us either. And then there's compulsory whiteness, which erases all of the hate crimes that are ongoing against Muslims and Arab and Iranians. And it's just so complicated. I think it's very charged.
Yeah. I've had the privilege to go back to Iran and kind of like, and I've spoke about this before, of like going to like meet all my extended family and like my aunts and uncles and my grandparents, and like kind of seeing that, like that helped kind of really give context to a lot of like my mental illness struggles of like meeting these people and then like kind of seeing what they went through and then like learning what my dad went through. Like I've talked about this before, but like my dad's oldest sister killed herself. And they, for the long years, I'd always like ask of like, well, you know, early, like, and my dad was just like, she was just sick. She was just sick. And to me, that meant like she was like internally, like she had like a, you know, some disease or something that killed her. But like nothing was ever like explained to me until I went to Iran and someone was like, no, she like was really struggling and ended up killing herself. And it is like all this like context I needed for so much of my life and everything I was like feeling and then like why my dad acted a certain way. It helped me like just understand that generational trauma, like where I was like, oh, I see what's going on and I almost felt like I could just reach out and like touch where it all stems from in a way of like, okay, I'm getting it. I see why those two people don't get along. Like it was like all these different little things that as a whole explained why my father was my father. And then in, you know, an extension of that, like why I am the way I am. And like that, I don't know. There's these things of like truly like going to where you come from and like feeling it, if that makes sense, like just even the energy of the situation, that was like huge for me. Cause then I truly like, I'd never truly understood generational trauma until I went and like fully engaged with my family in that setting. And my parents are the only people from their families that came to America. So I don't really have like true blood family in America. So like that was like a huge eye opener for me that like, it really does exist in that way. Like, It transfers to us. And I, oh man, explaining this to my therapist has always been great. I feel like I'm just doing that right now again.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
It's interesting.
I think it took this one conversation I had with my mom last year where, I mean, I kind of believed in generational trauma the whole time, but this one conversation I had with her where she told me about something incredibly traumatic that happened to her. And suddenly I was like, oh, like, I understand why I am the way I am now, you know, like you didn't even have to tell me my whole life. And I just like knew there's a part of you that's like living in me now. But let's take our last break. I'd love to talk to you about Savage Tongues when we come back. But first, here's some ads that are hopefully not that bad. Okay, we're back with Azarine. Vanderfleet, Lumi. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have done that. Okay, your third novel, Savage Tongues, it looks at questions of nationhood, memory, identity, some things that we've all been talking about this whole time that I think affect so many children of immigrants and migrants and first-gen people. It's also looking at gender and gender-based violence. And I want to know, Because your second novel took so long to conceive, was it the same process with this third one, or did you already have like an idea going in? I want to know what the process was like coming to this idea.
No, this one didn't take as long. It, you know, didn't really require as much, I guess, research. I mean, Kwame Zebra deals so much with like art, architecture, the politics of three different countries, right? Exile. Savage Tongues, the scope is a little bit, I mean, it's still a layered novel, which deals with, you know, a lot of the characters are from Iran and Lebanon and Palestine and Israel and the United States. And it deals with how those countries are set up to relate to one another, you know, now in the contemporary landscape, but also historically. So it's dealing with what does it mean to be sort of Muslim and Jewish in the world today, and what does it mean to build intimate friendships and queer family across those divisions, right? So there was a certain immediacy to the novel, you know, it's stream of consciousness, and it has a lot of, I think, the focus is really on this friendship, which is at the core of the novel between the Iranian American narrator and her best friend, Ellie, who's Israeli American and a Palestinian activist and scholar. And I think that in a way it was easier to write. And it's a different tone, a different kind of, it's exploring that violence that we experience in the American landscape, being from the Middle East, and the kind of cognitive dissonance of being here when you're from there, and having the countries be so antagonistic with one another and constantly at war. And I think that's an experience I have myself in my consciousness and in my body. So it was accessible to me in a different way.
Mm-hmm. I really appreciate that you're able to write, and that you do write, about gender constructs within the Muslim community and just the idea of sexual desire in general, because I think so many, every gender experiences this in a lot of conservative families, but I just think those things aren't ever talked about. So you grow up thinking like you don't understand anything about yourself. I had so many issues with my identity and my body. And a lot of that can be traced back to like the shame you feel just like existing in for me, like a female form. And I just really appreciate that when you choose to write about something, you're choosing to write about stuff that needs to be addressed. So I appreciate that a lot.
Yeah. And I think we can't like talk about race and ethnicity in America or anywhere in the world without also talking about sex, sexual relations, and the way that those things are determined by racial power lines or ethnic power lines, right? Like who you're allowed to desire or who you're encouraged to desire, mm-hmm. and the ways in which you desire someone with whom you're in an asymmetrical power relationship with, right?
Mm-hmm.
Those are all such complicated questions. So the novel's really dealing with what happens when we're stripped of our sexual agency as women and then thrown into this landscape of multiple layers of asymmetrical power dynamics across racial, ethnic, and class lines. And then what do we do? You know, like what happens basically when we're taught to hate ourselves to our sexual desires, and what do we allow others to do to us? So I think, it is something that needs to be talked about for sure.
Yeah. I just love that you're able to word everything that I've ever had in my head, but you're doing it so eloquently. And like, thank you. You're a writer. You really are a writer.
Well, you know, writing the novel was actually a way of getting language for something I was never given language for. So the novel itself traces that journey of these two friends trying to actually put in place. I mean, it's very introspective for that reason. Like it's the two of them trying to mine language for this experience so that they can understand it. And they do at the end. It's not easy getting there. So,
and also it's interesting. You're saying like the power structures within and specifically your book kind of explores like a large, you know, an age gap with a relationship between an older man and a younger mm-hmm. woman. And there's all this like, you know, like I feel like only truly in the last, what I feel like 20 years have we truly, even not even 20, maybe like 10 years, have we been really acknowledging like these power structures, like in relationships and like truly like what grooming is. Like, mm-hmm. I feel like these relationships got normalized of like the age gap. I mean, even like the Woody Allen movie, you know, like it's like all these different sort of media structures telling us like it happens, men date younger women without really acknowledging like the damage it can cause and like truly what's actually happening in this situation, that it's not just like, oh, well, she's 17, she's a woman. And it's like, no one who's only been alive for 17 years you can't just be like, that's a woman, she knows what she's doing. It's like you actually have to, you know, look beyond that and actually critically think about the situation, which I feel like a lot of people haven't done until recently. And I think that's always a very interesting thing to explore, because like when I was a kid, And I say like kid, like when I was a teenager and I would be like lusting over some older man. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, now I'm like, thank God I never really like did anything like that because I would have never been able to process it. Yeah. Especially because in our, you know, communities, who would have been there to help me process it? You know, I probably just would have been punished and told I was the problem. I was wrong. You know, like there would have been no sort of structure to help me understand any of it. And so like, I actually think about these things a lot. And when I was looking at your book, I was almost kind of scared to get into it because I was like, I don't want to think further into this. But I think like that's kind of like what is intriguing about it is like, I should because I do have these thoughts and I do think about these things a lot and I do need to like face it. Like it is what it is and we should be talking about it, even if it just makes you uncomfortable. But that's what's making me uncomfortable is my own kind of repressed experience, sexual experiences that I wasn't ever allowed to like process because of where I'm from and the family, and you know, we just don't have these sorts of structures set up to help us. And I don't know, I just think it's all very interesting. You hit on a lot of very interesting things where I'm like, oh. But then you write in a book.
It's not easy to go there, and I think like the book is difficult for that reason, right? Like you have to be willing to we've been sealed off from having these conversations, and it requires a great deal of like courage and I think persistence to break the silence. That's why I found the courage to write the book. It was that I was tired of the silence around these issues and the lack of detailed exploration from the female perspective. I think hopefully, once we've broken the silence and we begin to talk about these things as women in our communities, then it will feel less heavy. It's like if we don't go there, then the violence just continues.
Yeah. And I like the way, I feel like in just the last couple of years, I've realized that violence doesn't have to be this outright physical thing. Like there's a very like intimate violence that I feel like is maybe at times more catastrophic, right? Like not physical is what I'm trying to say. But I also think it's very prevalent in our communities. But at the same time, I appreciate that it's like a very universal feeling. Like for me, even I had to get over this idea that like my early 20s was like I was in my prime. You know what I mean? Like whatever that means, like to be a desirable woman or someone that presents as a female, you're like, you have to be so young compared to men that are just like, they never really have to experience that, you know? And I like the idea that we have to deprogram that part of us. And I think that's across every community, that the younger you are as a female presenting person, it's the more desirable you are. And even now with like trying to date, I have to like unprogram that part of myself being like, well, it's too late for me. I'm 31. It's just this part of you that you have to keep checking.
Yeah. I mean, some of my great aunts and, you know, cousins of my grandma, they were all married when they were 15. And actually recently I got to speak to one of them about how traumatic that was for her. And, you know, you look at the wedding pictures and she's like a child marrying a 40-year-old man. And it's, and we're always told, oh, when I graduated from college, my family had bought me all the stuff for the sofre for your wedding. And I just thought, why did I just spend 4 years in college? Yeah. And they were like, well, just in case your husband leaves you. Like, you got a degree just in case your husband leaves you. And I just thought, okay, you do you, I'll do me. You know, those are very traumatic experiences. And they're not, like, physically violent, but they are telling you to live in a certain way. And if you don't or can't or it doesn't resonate, then you're out on your own.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it always really bothers me how much of the female experience is centered around marriage and men. Like, even college doesn't matter. Like, they wait until, I mean, I understand certain communities, like sometimes getting married is the only way they can leave their father's home, but that's tragic, you know, like, to be a child and to be married off like a 40-year-old versus a 15-year-old, which is my grandmother was, I think, 14 when she was married to someone like 15 years her senior. I hate how centered that is. Like, the patriarchy just is so in control of the female experience. And, like, I have cousins that even, like, they're obsessed with the idea of marriage. Like, they really, like, in their hearts think that is the end goal. Like, that is their dream, to get married. But I also think part of it is programmed.
Yeah. I mean, my grandma had my mom when she was 16. Like,
well, this is why it's not easy to then go to your family and say either, oh, I'm experiencing sexual desire as a 16-year-old toward an older man, or I was manipulated or groomed, you know, at 16 or 17 by an older man, because they're, you know, if they have trauma around their young age marriage to an older person, they haven't processed it. And also, how can you know what having or losing agency means if you haven't processed your own trauma, right? So it's kind of like, if you were to talk about, or anyone talks about it, then you're requiring them to unpack that experience, and they may not want to or be ready to. And it's a really tough conversation.
I think the concept of sexual agency is so important. And when you're never even allowed to realize that you have it, it's hard to even get that back, you know, like if it's deprogrammed, or like if you feel shame from such a young age, or if you get married off when you're young, there's no agency about that. I mean, this is maybe TMI, and I hope no one listens to this in my family, but my cousin just got married. And the first question that my aunt asked her, who's close to her, she was like, well, how was it? Like, there's this Arabic saying where it's, and it's translated, it's like, shoot the hyena. There's like a euphemism to like the first time doing it, which is also just telling of like how not nice that is for females, shoot the hyena. But that was the first thing she asked her, because she was saying like, it's important you like this because your husband will want to do this a lot, you know, like, so how do you feel? And she was like, I feel fine. You know what I mean? But like, I don't know. It makes me really sad that so much of our experience, so much of our literal like things that are going on within us is about how the partner feels, how the man feels.
I mean, that kind of language sets women up for thinking that it's a service they have to provide.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
The more I think about it as we're having this discussion, like and this has actually been fresh on my mind lately, but I have a cousin, she's still with us, who now is probably about in her early 20s, but about 2017, and again, I mean, they won't listen to this because they're in Iran and they don't care, but she, at 17, was just barely finishing school, was engaged to a 30-year-old man, and I was in Iran for their engagement party, and I was fucking livid. And I was like, what the fuck? No one else? Like, my dad, bless my father, who I am very lucky to have parents who, like, have never really pressured me to, you know, get married or anything. And I think a lot of that has to do with my mom's dad having multiple wives and being in polygamous relationships in Iran, that my mom is very jaded by that. And I think it also explains why she left Iran as quick as she could. But my dad fully, like, blew up this party of like, I don't fuck with this. Like, my dad's very loud and very obnoxious, and he will tell you he'll tell you exactly how it feels straight to your face, which as a young woman, brutal, but you know, in a situation like this, was actually kind of amazing to watch him be like, this is fucked up. Like, this is all fucked up. I know he has money, but you shouldn't marry him because he has money. You're 17, he's 30, and probably an asshole. Like, literally. And my cousin, well, the girl's my second cousin. She's my cousin's kids. And my cousin pulls my dad out and is basically like, you can't stay here because you are acting like this. My dad's like, I'm just telling you the truth. Good luck with the divorce in a few years. And then it was honestly truly, I was like, dad, I was like, reality TV. I was like, what? Like, what the fuck? You can just do that? But a part of me was like, I should have also been like, fuck this. Because deep down, I was like, it's not even deep down. I was pretty much like, this is fucked up. But I'm here out of respect for my family because I'm in Iran and I can't be the weird American cousin who's like, I'm not going, you know, just so many levels of like cultural stuff. Like, I was not happy, but watching my dad blow that shit up and then be like, fine, I'm out, I'll go sit outside. And then, you know what? They are getting divorced. So in a way, my dad was like, yeah, this is really shady. And now it's a really hard divorce because the guy doesn't want her to go and he has to grant the divorce because that's what Iranian law is. So it's like, And now she's like struggling to get out of this marriage. And it's just, it's all just so fucked up.
Yeah. But even that, like, a divorced woman in the Middle East is like, she's like ruined, you know, like no one, it's like hard to remarry as a divorcee. And she's so young.
Yeah.
It's like, it's just, it's a mistake that will exist for the rest of her life. And I mean, I don't know, even me, like my, I never wanted to get married. And I say that all the time to my parents, but my mom was like, you'll grow out of this. You don't want to be alone. Like my sister was getting married on Saturday, and all those questions of like, you're next, you know, like, how about you? And all this other, I don't know. I think my mom has this idea that like, it'll be so depressing for you to be alone for the rest of your life. But I thought that I want to be alone. I'll have a partner someday, you know, yeah. I just want to be married to them. Yeah. Anyways.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
Our communities, what a lot. It could be a lot to process, but.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's, I think it's important to talk about the challenges and also to lift our cultures up because there's so much richness and just so much to learn from and to exist in, right? But at the same time, like naming these things is really critical.
Yeah. I'm glad that you brought that up because we've been kind of very critical this whole time about our cultures. But at the same time, you're right. There's so much richness. It's so beautiful. There's so much beauty and culture that exists in these communities. And
so much joy and
yeah,
sense of humor and
yes, yeah, and food,
good food, and everyone yeah. will tear their shirt off their backs for you. I mean, there yeah. it's, I think it's just I'm bringing it up because it's like every culture, there's good and there's bad, and
exactly
it's, we shouldn't have to say that, but I think in the context of all of the just terrorizing media and the dehumanizing mm-hmm. media, I always try to sort of be like, we're like everyone else.
Exactly. It's not just a Muslim problem. It's not just a Middle Eastern problem. Every culture has good and bad. We're just trying to tackle it.
And sexism is a global phenomenon, and men suffer because of it, and women suffer. And, you know, we have Trump here, so.
The patriarchy exists across the board. You know, like, it's not just patriarchy, rather. It's not just brown people problems. It's every people problems. This has been such a lovely conversation. We really appreciate giving so much of your time to us. And we can't wait for this book to go on sale on August 3rd, Savage Tongues. Pre-order it.
Also, the link and everything will be in the description below.
Yes. Easy access. And until then, you can buy Call Me Zebra. You can read that through. Your first book is called
Fraud Healer. I'm not on social media much, but I do have an Instagram where people can get
books. What's your handle?
It's my name, Ozarine.VanderVleet-Alumi.
Perfect. And we'll have that in the description as well. But yeah, thank you so much. Your insight is invaluable. And again, I can't tell you how nice it is to hear stuff that like has ricocheted in my mind my whole life, like articulated in a really cohesive, understandable way. So thank you for that. And it's Ethnically Ambiguous, Ethnically Amb, A-M-B on Twitter, and Ethnically Ambig, A-M-B-I-G on Instagram. I'm Shireen, Shirohiro on Instagram, and Shirohiro666 on Twitter.
And I'm at AnaHoste on Twitter. Woohoo! Follow Ozarine.
Yeah, follow Ozarine. And
get the book.
Until next time, pre-order her book, Savage Tongues, and read her other ones. Call Me Zebra. It's great. Thank you. Bye.
Ethnically Ambiguous is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.